130 docket, Azar versus Winston and Black Diamond Fund versus Joseph. Are the attorneys present on each case? Okay. You should have been provided a handout of our procedures. If anyone in the courtroom has a cell phone or pager, please make sure it's turned off so it doesn't interrupt us during the arguments, and let's begin with Azar.
May it please the court and opposing counsel, my name is Jesse Brandt, and I'm here on behalf of plaintiff appellant Franklin D. Azar and Associates PC in this matter. This appeal arises from a grant of summary judgment in favor of defendants Joseph R. Winston and Winston and Associates. We're here today because we believe the trial court erred both substantively and procedurally in granting summary judgment in favor of the Winston defendants. I'd like to begin with the procedural components of the summary judgment order first and our contentions of error. Initially, this lawsuit was filed in Denver District Court. It was moved to El Paso County District Court on a change of venue motion, successful change of venue motion. In lieu of filing an answer, the Winston defendants instead filed a motion for summary judgment. And took the position that no discovery was appropriate. We, in responding to the motion for summary judgment, requested CRCP 56F relief, including some specifically identified depositions, as well as a request that the court order the parties to begin the mandatory disclosure procedure under Rule 26. Ultimately, the court granted leave to conduct 56F discovery. Once we began that process, we ran into some additional procedural hurdles that precluded the discovery to take place in the initial 60-day period. And with that, I'll begin with our first procedural point of error. What the Winston defendants have done here is filed a motion for summary judgment in lieu of an answer, and in effect, have circumvented the mandatory disclosure requirements of Rule 26 and successfully, at least in part, precluded the Azar, precluded my client, Azar, from conducting any meaningful discovery in this matter. Then, in conjunction with that, argued for summary judgment and argued that there were no material facts precluding summary judgment in this matter. That argument was ultimately successful, and the trial court found that that Azar had not met its burden of establishing whether there was disputed facts in existence. However, we believe that process was flawed for the following reasons. Rule 12 provides that within 20 days of an answer, or of a complaint, rather, that a party is to file an answer or a response of pleading. It then goes on to provide that one of the response of pleadings under Rule 12 or Rule 12B is a motion setting forth the five Rule 12 legal issues that we typically see in a motion to dismiss. Rather than filing a motion, a Rule 12 motion to dismiss or filing an answer, they instead filed a motion for summary judgment. Rule 12 is clear in that it requires a response of pleading, and we believe that under Rule 7 is an answer. A motion for summary judgment is not a pleading by definition.
Counsel, sorry to interrupt. Isn't the Welp case fairly on point?
Well, in the Welp case, that's distinguishable on two points. Is one, while the Supreme Court in Welp ultimately said that it was not necessary that a party could file a motion for summary judgment before filing an answer, it didn't ultimately address the question of whether it relieves a party from filing an answer. And also in the Welp case, there was a discovery done that was not done here, and that included an affidavit and depositions. That distinction is important here because effectively what we have is a motion for summary judgment that was ultimately granted on a series of argument from counsel and unsworn CR evidence that doesn't meet the Rule 56 burden. What the Winston defendants did in filing this motion for summary judgment is attempt to kind of straddle a line between a response of pleading and a motion for summary judgment. And you can find that in the footnote one of the motion for summary judgment, in which they attempt to set forth their affirmative defenses to preserve them. What they didn't do was specifically deny the factual averments in the complaint.
Counsel, when things were all said and done, what was attached to the motion for summary judgment that the district court relied on? Was it not letters issued by your client to his former clients?
Some of those, Your Honor. I believe the first two exhibits that remained after the withdrawal of the affidavit consisted of several letters from Mr. Winston to an attorney employed by my client. I believe the remainder of the exhibits consisted either of settlement memorandum.
From your client?
Correct.
To his former clients?
Correct.
What did your client file, if anything, in opposition to the motion for summary judgment that denied the basis of any of those statements made in his prior letters?
Well, I'll address that. What we filed in opposition to the summary judgment motion was what we referenced, first of all, this was when the affidavits were still connected to the motion for summary judgment. A significant amount of Rule 56 evidence contesting the credibility of the affiants, and this was initially in our initial response, and I believe it was September of 08. But as to the contesting the validity of those settlement memorandum and the documents, there was no question of validity of those.
And isn't that all that the district court relied on in finding that the clients were no longer the clients of Mr. Azar at the time they, let's say, switched their representation to Mr. Winston?
Well, some of those, yes, and that is what the district court referenced. However, and this is the substantive aspect of the trial court's ruling that we disagree with, the district court also placed greater weight on the legal importance of those memorandums as far as when the matter was concluded than we believe was appropriate in terms of supporting the Winston defendant's motion for summary judgment. Those settlement memoranda and the letters established that those at that point in time with those particular clients, some aspect of the representation had been closed. With respect to two of the former clients of Azar, Shauna Jimenez, actually three, Nicholas Olguin and Jackie Ramsey, they had ongoing attorney-client relationships at the time it was terminated.
With Mr. Azar?
Correct.
So did he file an affidavit that set forth that evidence in opposition to the motion for summary judgment?
No, there wasn't an affidavit, Your Honor. What we did was reference in the case of Shauna Jimenez, the affidavit that was ultimately withdrawn by the Winston defendants references this ongoing relationship. And we referenced that in responding to the summary judgment.
Did anything prevent Mr. Azar from responding to those asserted facts with his own affidavit?
No, but what we have here, Your Honor, is a case of a statement in an affidavit that was ultimately withdrawn, but I don't believe that precludes my client from using it in response to a summary judgment motion. But we have an affidavit from Shauna Jimenez that establishes an ongoing relationship in addition to the relationship that was concluded as reflected in the settlement memoranda, or settlement memorandum, rather, with respect
right.
to.
And that affidavit was withdrawn?
Correct.
And then did your client put an affidavit explaining to the court that that relationship purportedly still continued?
No, there was no affidavit submitted on behalf of the firm, Your Honor. So I believe when I left off, I was discussing the legal effect of Rule 8 and the attempt by the Winston defendants to straddle the line between an answer and a motion for summary judgment. And one of the points I wanted to make was that, as I mentioned before, they attempted to preserve their defenses, but did not specifically deny the factual averments in the complaint. The operative effect of that under Rule 8 is that those factual averments in the complaint are effectively admitted. And for that reason, we believe it was inappropriate for the trial court to find that there were no issues of disputed fact to preclude summary judgment in this case. I'd like to talk a little bit about Rule 16. One of the issues we've raised here, again, procedurally, is whether this process is appropriate to circumvent summary judgment, or excuse me, to circumvent the disclosure requirements of Rule 26. Rule 16 provides that a case is at issue once the party has filed a response to pleading. it's clear, at least the intended effect of that preservation of defenses was to operate as a, in part at least, a responsive pleading on behalf of the Winston defendants. They raised them in their motion for summary judgment, and accordingly didn't intend to waive those. So that, for all practical purposes, constitutes a responsive pleading. We believe that should have triggered the Rule 16 Act issue deadlines and also in turn trigger the mandatory disclosure requirement of Rule 26. That in turn would allow the parties to begin conducting meaningful discovery, which is what the disclosure process is intended to facilitate. In fact, the disclosure process is triggered by the complaint and then the response of pleading, so the parties can determine what documents or what facts are in dispute based on the pleadings. We were never allowed to begin that process, and in fact, let me back up a little bit. It's a bit of an overstatement. The trial court, in response to a 56F motion supported by an affidavit, initially provided us 60 days to conduct discovery before responding to the motion. The day after the trial court entered its order, we began requesting deposition dates from the Winston defendants. Four such requests were made, and no response was provided. And then shortly after the last request, the Winston defendants filed a motion for protective order. That the briefing of that and the resolution of that lasted until mid-December of 2007, I believe. And that affects
Mr. Brad, I think we know the history. All the judges read the briefs. Tell us what discovery you didn't get from these former clients that you needed to make an opposition to the summary judgment.
Sure. We were not, because these people, these former clients, were represented by counsel, represented by Mr. Winston and his alleged co-conspirator in the complaint, Mr. LaHoulier. We were prevented from speaking to these people at all. The purpose of the 56F discovery was to conduct discovery, deposition discovery, on the what happened as between Mr. Winston and these former clients. That's an opportunity we couldn't explore. That's an area of question we couldn't explore because we weren't allowed to contact these people outside of the scope of a deposition.
Well, did you ask the court for assistance to enable you to take those depositions?
In terms of?
In other words, you said you attempted to set a date with opposing counsel, but did you ask the court to enter an order regarding these depositions?
We did not, Your Honor. What happened after the initial 56F order was granted is that motion protective order was filed, and that has the effect of staying all the discovery to which it's directed. That ate up a good portion of the original 60-day time frame. The trial court ultimately denied that motion protective order, and then shortly thereafter, the Winston defendants filed a motion for reconsideration of that motion for protective order, but to answer your question, no, we deny it.
Well, there were two 60-day extensions, weren't there?
Correct.
So it was 120 days.
Correct.
And during that whole time period, you never asked for court assistance to get the depositions taken.
Correct. And during a significant portion of that time frame, there were a motion for protective order and then a motion for reconsideration of the court's prior ruling on the motion for protective order pending, both of which, at least particularly with respect to the initial motion for protective order, preclude any discovery on those depositions. But we did not go back a second time or go to the court. Any process of noticing a deposition is complicated in a case such as this, because we don't have the opportunity to confer directly with these prospective deponents because they're represented by counsel who also happens to be a defendant in this lawsuit. So we are somewhat at the mercy of the Winston defendants' counsel in this matter in terms of getting those depositions set. And as it happened, we were involved in a good portion of the entire 120-day response period involved in disputes over what would be a permissible line of questioning in those depositions. Now, I believe I mentioned the Rule 56F continuance. That was initially granted by the court. And as I mentioned, we burn through the initial 60-day response period for various reasons. But we did make diligent attempts to schedule these depositions. The second component of, Winter responded to the motion for summary judgment in January of 2008, we reiterated our request for Rule 56F relief, and that was not addressed by the trial court, implicitly rejected, I suppose. But we weren't ever allowed to conduct the 56F deposition discovery. We did conduct some limited written discovery. And I see my yellow light is on, and unless you have any questions for me immediately, I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Actually, your time is up now. I believe the red light is on.
Thank you.
May it please the court, I'm John R. Mann of Kennedy, Childs & Fogg here on behalf of the defendants appellees, Joseph R. Winston and Joseph R. Winston, PC. Rather than going to the facts of this case, I just want to get right down to the issue, which is that because the trial court's order granting summary judgment for the defendants was based on the statute of limitations and the undisputed, uncontested, unchallenged evidence establishing that the Azar firm itself ended its relationships with its former clients, there's no need to address the discovery issue unless the trial court erred in holding there was no fact issue on either of these grounds. This is because the only discovery plaintiff claims it needs concerns defendant's intent, or as he said, what Mr. Winston said to the former clients, not the statute of limitations and not anything relating to the existence of the underlying contracts or the alleged interference. And the trial court necessarily assumed the element of intent when it granted summary judgment. In other words, if the trial court was correct in its ruling, the issues on which the plaintiff contends it needed discovery are simply immaterial because the tortious interference claim could not succeed even if the defendants actually intended to interfere with the plaintiff's relationships with its former clients.
Well, let me explore that a minute, Mr. Mann. The trial court's findings are a bit sparse, I'll have to admit, on the summary judgment. But it seems like the main finding is contained in paragraph 6, where he says, it's clear from the submission of the defendants that plaintiff considered its contractual agreement terminated.
Correct.
Therefore, there's no way your client could interfere with the contract. That was seems to be what the judge is saying.
Yes.
But Mr. Brandt just told us that there was some evidence before the judge that there was an ongoing client relationship with at least one of these former clients. I think her name was Shauna Jimenez. So if there was evidence of that, how could the court make this finding that it was clear and unrebutted?
But there wasn't any evidence of that. There wasn't. There was a letter signed by an attorney for Mr. Azar's firm that says, by signing this agreement, and there was one for Ms. Jimenez, by signing this agreement, you understand this ends the contractual agreement between you and Franklin D. Azar and Associates. Now, each one of these documents was signed by an attorney for Mr. Azar's firm, and it was signed by the client. So this is not just an admission of a party opponent. It's a document with independent legal significance establishing the termination of a contract, and that's what the trial court relied on. They didn't come up with any other evidence indicating, and I think an affidavit from the attorney at the firm saying, oh, no, we still have a relationship with Shauna Jimenez. That would seem like something that they could have submitted, and because that's evidence that is exclusively, if not exclusively, under their control. But instead, would they submit a court document? It's ambiguous, nothing to explain it, certainly not anything with the clarity of that signed agreement saying our contractual arrangement or contractual agreement is ended. And that's what the trial court relied on. They didn't challenge that. They didn't challenge the authenticity of it. They didn't challenge the validity of it. No affidavit from the attorney who wrote it and signed it saying this isn't what we intended. Nothing. That evidence was, as the trial court said, was uncontested. And in a claim for tortious interference with contract, if you read the jury instruction on the issue, the very first element is the plaintiff had a contract with a third party. That is a fundamental element of a tortious interference with contract claim. Here, the plaintiff didn't even establish that element with respect to the Pappases and with respect to Shauna Jimenez. The undisputed evidence established that attorney-client contract or the contractual relationship had terminated before the defendants even contacted the plaintiffs or before the lawsuits were filed. There was also evidence uncontested as far as another former client, Ms. Lisa Seneca, that they had disavowed the relationship years and years before the complaint was brought. So as far as the evidence that the trial court relied on, it was uncontested. There were a couple of other plaintiffs, a couple other former clients mentioned, but the trial court found that the plaintiff had not submitted any evidence regarding them. I think it was Ramsey and Olguin to show that a attorney-client relationship existed. Again, this could have easily been established by them by submitting a signed written contract, by an affidavit from one of their attorneys saying that this relationship still existed. It's not hard for them to get. It's evidence that is within their possession, custody, or control that they could have come up forward with on summary judgment, but they did not. So I think in this case, the plaintiff doesn't even get to the square one of the claim for tortious interference because they can't show that there was a contract that was interfered with. In fact, they haven't even attempted to articulate what this interference was, because in the tort of tortious interference, there are generally three ways or so that a contract can be interfered with. You can prevent the formation of a contract, you can prevent or the performance of a contract either by the plaintiff or by the third party, or induce a third party not to perform the contract, or you can induce the third party to breach the contract. No evidence of any of that was submitted by the plaintiff on summary judgment. Even assuming they could show an existing contract or attorney-client relationship, they came forward with no evidence at all to show that there was any interference. And the discovery they want to conduct, which concerns solely the intent or the propriety of the alleged interference, simply isn't a consideration when you don't have evidence that there was a contract or that that contract was ever interfered with. And the trial court, we could have had, let's just assume that the evidence showed that the defendant said, we're going to take Azar down and we want you to help. Assume the worst possible scenario for intent that they could have discovered. Would that have changed the result of the summary judgment? No, because there is no evidence that there was a contract. They came forward with no evidence to show any kind of interference. And the claim involving Mr. Crow, as the trial court found, was barred by the statute of limitations because the plaintiff were well aware of the defendant's representation of Mr. Crow. And in fact, they waited until after the Supreme Court came out with the decision in Crow versus Toll to even assert this claim. So if they're going to say, well, we didn't have damages, they had damages when that complaint against them was filed by Mr. Crow back in 2004, more than 2 years before the complaint was filed. So again, they didn't come up with any evidence opposing the statute of limitations on Mr. Crow's claim. Nor have they said, well, we need to conduct discovery. The Rule 56 discovery is not directed to the existence of contracts. It's not directed to interference. It's not directed to statute of limitations. All it is directed to, well, we want to see what Mr. Winston said to the former clients. If the statute of limitations is run, that doesn't matter. Again, the court could assume, for purposes of the standard review, which is view the complaint in light most favorable to the plaintiff, that the plaintiff had established that element. The plaintiff still loses.
When you say there was no contract, do you mean by that these were contracts that were terminable at will, or that these were contracts which had actually been terminated?
These were contingent fee contracts that had been performed and terminated, as you see from the letters that were the closing letters that were sent to the client. They said, this contract has been performed, you got your money, we got our money, the relationship is ended.
So that for your argument doesn't hinge on the fact that attorney-client contracts are always terminable at will under Colorado law?
You know, that's really an interesting issue, but I don't think this court has to reach that issue to decide this case. It can decide it on the grounds. It does present an interesting issue, which is, can you really have the tort of interference with the attorney-client relationship? Because it's not a contract then. If it's not a specific contract, we're just talking about an attorney-client relationship. Can that be interfered with when the client has the absolute right to discharge an attorney at any time for any reason, with or without cause, probably for some reasons that in other situations a court might find illegal? I mean, you could discharge an attorney because you don't like his race or his religion or her gender. And that would, there would be nothing against public policy that way. So if a client can discharge an attorney for any reason at any time, can there really be a breach of the attorney-client relationship? And if there can be no breach of the relationship, how can there be liability for inducing the breach of that relationship? It's an interesting question, but I don't think the court needs to reach it in this case, because I think the case can be narrowly decided on the grounds relied on by the trial court. I think, as the court well knows, on summary judgment, once the moving party has made a prima facie showing that there is no material fact dispute and that they're entitled to judgment as a matter of law, the burden shifts to the plaintiff to come forward with specific evidence showing a triable issue of fact. And here, on the grounds that summary judgment were sought, statute of limitations, absence of a contract, the plaintiff didn't come forward with anything, as the court noted in its questions to the plaintiff's counsel. I do want to talk a bit about the contention that this was procedurally incorrect because a summary judgment motion was filed in lieu of an answer. Again, the Supreme Court has said there's nothing wrong with this. There's no time limit in Rule 56 on a defendant filing a motion. The only time limit in Rule 56 is the plaintiff can't file a summary judgment motion until 20 days after the commencement of the action, and summary judgment motions must be filed 75 days before trial. That's it. A defendant can file, and in fact, if we'd call this a motion to dismiss for failure to state a claim, and the trial court said, well, I'm going to convert it to a summary judgment motion because it refers to matters outside the pleadings, it would be no different than from what happened. And you would think that if a summary judgment motion can't be filed after, in lieu of an answer, there'd be some case law from somewhere saying that can't be done. Have they cited any? No. We've cited federal case law and state case law saying it's absolutely an acceptable procedure. And, you know, there is no case law cited, no treatise, no Wright and Miller, no Moore's federal practice saying that this is an improper procedure or that it's procedurally wrong.
Do you agree that the summary judgment's not a response of pleading within the meaning of Rule 12, though?
I think it is a response under Rule 12A. I mean, the question is, what's a responsive pleading? Because if you want to go to the hyper-technical definition, then a Rule 12b-5 motion, a Rule 12b-1 motion to dismiss for lack of subject matter jurisdiction, not a responsive pleading because it's not a pleading, it's just a response.
But the case law seems to say that a plaintiff's allowed to amend his complaint if all that's been filed is either a Rule 12 motion or a Rule 56 motion, isn't that correct?
Yes.
And didn't the plaintiff here attempt to amend his complaint?
I think if an answer has not been filed and only a summary judgment motion, I think the plaintiff could amend his complaint.
So when the court here denied their request to amend the complaint, was that error?
It was not an abuse of discretion, because what were they going to amend the complaint to assert? You're telling the trial court, we want to amend our complaint, and the trial court's going, to assert what? Well, we want to amend the complaint. To assert what? Well, we just want to amend. If you don't let the trial court know what you're going to amend the complaint to assert, what new claims, what new facts are going to be added, then how can you say the court abused its discretion when it didn't have the information before it that would know what was going to be amended?
No amended complaint, proposed amended complaint was ever tendered here?
No motion to amend was ever filed. It was just mentioned at the end of a response to a summary judgment motion. Well, we want to file a motion to amend. We intend to amend the complaint. There is no motion for leave to amend in the record, no tendered amended complaint. So there's nothing for the trial court to know what was proposed to be amended, and nor is there for this court. So how, in that case, the trial court certainly did not abuse its discretion in denying leave to amend when it didn't know what the amendment was going to be.
Well, it doesn't sound like leave was ever actually requested.
No, it wasn't.
Sort of a notice.
It was notice. It said, we're going to amend the complaint, but no motion for leave was ever formally filed, and no amended complaint was submitted to the trial court so it could determine whether the amended claims should be allowed. So in conclusion, I realize that this case may have some larger, or touch on some larger legal issues, mainly the one whether attorney-client relationship can be breached like a contract. or whether the client's absolute right to discharge the attorney forecloses such a claim, but this case can be decided on much narrower grounds without reaching these issues. Namely, the fact that it was undisputed that the plaintiff had no existing contracts or relationships that the defendants could have interfered with, and that the plaintiff simply waited too long to bring his claim regarding Mr. Crow. In fact, they waited until after the Supreme Court had issued its decision in Crow versus Tall, which was certainly too long. And in fact, because the plaintiff in its opening brief really didn't challenge any of these grounds on summary judgment in its appeal, but instead focused on the Rule 56 issue, which again, as I pointed out, is at the most harmless because none of that evidence, and they haven't shown how that any of the evidence they sought to discover on what Mr. Winston said to the former clients would have changed the trial court's rulings on either limitations or the non-existence of a contract. We'd ask that the judgment be affirmed on the grounds relied on by the trial court. If there are no further questions, I want to thank you for your attention.
All right, thank you, counsel, for your arguments. The case will stand submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course.